Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Family law is a broad field in the legal world. It encompasses adoption, reproductive technology, domestic violence, marriage equality, custody, and of course, divorce. Facing the complexities of one or more of these issues is impossible without the advice and guidance of a good family law attorney. Margaret Law works every day as one of those attorneys. She is a founding partner of Berner, Claw & Watson in Philadelphia. She's also the author of Keeping It Civil, The Case of the Prenup and the Porsche and Other True Accounts from the Files of a Family Lawyer. Margaret Claw has been named a preeminent woman lawyer and recognized as a Pennsylvania super lawyer for the past 5 years, and she joins us this morning from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia. And Margaret Claw, welcome to Up to Date. So nice to have you today.
Thanks so much. It's great to be with you.
You write in here, Margaret, lawyers either love or hate family law. Why do they hate it?
Well, I think the reasons that they hate it are probably the same reasons that those of us who love it, because it is very emotionally intense. It's a practice area where you're dealing with raw human emotion and you're dealing with the issues that are so important to all of us, you know, our most intimate relationships, our kids, our marriages. And so you have to be able to want to have a work life where your, daily life is involved with these issues with other people. And for some lawyers, that's just really uncomfortable. And I think that they find it too draining, which it can be draining for sure. So I think those of us who practice it and really like it learn to create a little bit of a boundary between ourselves and our clients, or otherwise we would just burn out.
Yeah. I was going to say, because you call yourself a family law junkie, what do you find so riveting about it? I guess it's just the things you just outlined, but why are you so drawn to that kind of intense drama day after day?
Well, it is partly what I just described about the intense drama and the highs and the lows. And I just I'm fascinated by families in all of their various configurations. But the other thing about it is that it's such an interesting area of the law. It's changing so incredibly fast. I mean, the definition of family in our society is morphing as we speak, and the law is struggling to keep up with society in some instances, and in others, it's pushing the culture. The same-sex marriage is a perfect example, because when the Massachusetts Supreme Court found that it was unconstitutional under the Massachusetts Constitution to prohibit same-sex marriage, that's our first same-sex marriage decision. That was in 2004, and that was radical. I mean, that's less than a decade ago. You know, that was a radical move, and that was really where the courts were out ahead of public opinion. And now that tide has turned so dramatically, and we're seeing, like in my state where there is no same-sex marriage, or it's prohibited by a state Defense of Marriage Act, that we have our own one in Pennsylvania. Now my state is seeing a upsurge of litigation challenging that, and of new legislation being introduced. And so the takeaway on that in all the news stories is we're lagging behind the mainstream opinion now. A majority of Pennsylvanians favor same-sex marriage. So it's really like a push-pull situation with the law and society, and I find that very interesting.
We're visiting with Margaret Claw. She's the author of Keeping It Civil, The Case of the Prenup and the Porsche and Other True Accounts from the Files of a Family Lawyer. Margaret, give us a sense, other senses of how rapidly the law has changed just in the time that you've been in practice. I mean, are there other examples that you might point to?
There are. I think one of the really big areas of change is the recognition of the importance of relationships that children have with people who aren't their biological parents. There's this concept in the law of the psychological parent, and there's been a really big shift in the last couple of decades in judicial recognition and protection of the relationship a child might have with a step-parent, with a partner of a biological parent, be it, same-sex partner or not, with grandparents, with just other third parties that are involved in the child's life. And that's a really – that's sort of a core idea of what is a family that is different, I think, than even when I first started practicing in the 80s. I feel that that's a big change. Yeah. And it plays out in the alternative family structure setting, you know, in the same-sex couples and in reproductive technology where you have more than two people involved in the creation of a child. But there's this kernel throughout it all that children can have a relationship with more than just the people who are their either biological or adopted parents, and that the law should protect that in some circumstances. Yeah.
You know, Margaret, you were talking a few minutes ago about just how intense this whole notion of being a family lawyer can be. How important is it, you know, given that, to maintain, you know, some level of detachment, you know, not getting too personally involved in any one client's case? Because it's very clear from this book that you've had to learn that lesson the hard way.
Yeah, and I mentioned that up front, that I think that is the key to being able to maintain enthusiasm and interest in a family law practice for lawyers, is to have the ability to create a boundary to some degree with our clients. If it's too high of a boundary, then you would just stop caring. Mm-hmm. So I think the key is to have enough of a separation that you can go home at the end of the day and not think that your life is the same life as your clients. You know, you can pay attention to your own family, but you still have compassion and empathy for your client's situation. And when I was thinking about this issue, because this was something I really wanted to write about when I wrote the book, because I was thinking a lot about, you know, what does it mean to be a family lawyer?
Mm-hmm.
And just sitting down to write about that topic, I was able to pinpoint this one particular moment in my practice where I had this realization that I had to create some boundary between myself and my clients. And it was when I was a very new lawyer and I had one of my first custody cases. Which
Darlene and Keith, I think you're talking about.
Yes, Darlene
and
Keith.
Yeah.
It kicks off the book in a chapter I call The Wall, because it's really about building some kind of a wall. And yeah, so Darlene was a teenage mom who had a baby who happened to be the exact same age as my second child at the time. We both had 10-month-old baby girls, and she was abused by her boyfriend, who was the father of the baby. And we went to court, and there was a shocking result, which is that the judge took the baby away from both her and the dad and gave custody of the baby to the paternal grandparents. And I was just, I couldn't believe that this happened. And Darlene
fell apart in the courthouse.
Fell apart. Darlene went outside the courtroom. I had to drag her outside the courtroom screaming, and then she dropped to the floor in the fetal position and started screaming, "How, you know, that's my baby. How can you take her away from me?" And quote that I know I put in the book because I'll never forget it is, "I have the stretch marks to prove it." And she was like showing her stretch marks to the court officers who, you know, were just looking on like, "Oh my God, what do we do here?" And I felt sick about it. And I felt sick like my baby had been taken away from me. And it was a Friday. And then I went home and I had this torturous weekend where I looked at my daughter sleeping in her crib and would start to cry. And I felt so bad.
And here comes the kicker. Yeah.
Well, right. So the kicker is at the moment of realization, like I can't do this anymore this way, is that I came to work on Monday all steeled up to talk to her to try to figure out how we were going to get this baby back. And, you know, because I felt like I was a total professional failure. It wasn't I felt that I had, you know, done this terrible wrong for her and I had to fix it. And anyway, I spoke to her on the phone and I started launching into the speech about what we were going to do. And she said, "Oh, don't worry about it. Everything's fine. Keith gave me a ring and we got engaged and we're all back living together. And thanks so much." And then she hung up.
Never mind.
Never mind. And so, you know, so at first I was just like furious at her. How could she make this bad decision? And this guy was abusive and everything. And then I felt sorry for myself. Like how, and I was mad at her for ruining my weekend. And that's the moment that I realized I decided, like, I have to I have to realize that her baby's not my baby and her life is not my life. And if she wants to make a decision, I don't think is a good decision. There's only so much I can do about that.
Yeah.
That's not
yeah.
my role. And I think every lawyer who practices family law for a period of time and likes it like I do, I bet they all have that Darlene moment
in
their careers.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting because it just reminds me that every profession, you know, probably has certain things to consider, certain standards you need to sort of think about. You know, and I cover politics for a living, and I remember my dad years ago telling me, you know, whatever you do, son, don't get so chewed up by cynicism that you can't do your job anymore. And he was so right. You know, it's so easy to get absolutely consumed by that, particularly at a time like this when the government shut down and the debt ceiling is about to be broken and all these things are happening. But you're right. If you lose perspective, you really can't do your job very well anymore.
Right. You can't. It definitely translates to many professions where you feel passionately about what you do and you care so much. And that's why you're good at doing what you do. I mean, I can't even imagine being a doctor dealing with life or death
yes.
issues all the time.
Yes.
But it's a, you know, a little bit of that in my world, for sure.
You've got to have a wall, but you can't lose all sense of compassion and empathy and everything else. Yeah, it's a real tricky line to walk in some ways. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it is. And I think that's why there are these so many lawyers that hate it because,
yeah.
you know, I'll talk to a lawyer at a bar association event or something. And, you know, he asks, what do I do? I say, I do family law. And I say, what does he do? And he says, oh, family law. You know, I did one divorce once and I'll never do another one because
yeah. –
because to that lawyer, it is just too messy and draining, and I get that. It's just if you're a family law junkie like I am, and you think these issues are so interesting. I mean, compared to what a lot of other lawyers do, and I hope I'm not insulting anyone out there, but this stuff is great.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, it's what matters to people, and
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of law that involves things that I find. Well, maybe intellectually interesting to write a really great contract about a commercial transaction, but I don't really care.
Yeah, right.
I don't really care.
Right.
And this I really care about.
Our guest again, author Margaret Claus. She's a family attorney. Her new book is titled Keeping It Civil, The Case of the Prenup and the Porsche and Other True Accounts from the Files of a Family Lawyer. We want to know what our listeners think about all this. What did you learn going through a divorce? If you've gone through this process, what did you learn that you wouldn't do again? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Our email address, UpToDate@kcur.org. You can also email us or tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. You know, Margaret, did you ever allow yourself to feel badly for the other parent in a divorce case? I'm thinking specifically of the relocation case that involved your client. Her name was Susan, at least in the book. Give us a sketch of that case.
Yeah, and the answer is yes. I often feel badly for the other parent because I could just as easily be representing the other parent. And in any kind of case I'm doing, I mean, I've been practicing long enough that any sort of fact pattern, I've already have represented the person on the other side. So yes, that case was a case where I represented a woman who wanted to move across the country with her two young children. And she'd come to Philadelphia with her husband because he was an academic and he got a position at a university here. And she never liked it here. And the understanding had been that as soon as he got tenure, that he would be able to sort of leverage that to get a tenured position back where they came from, which was in the book, I believe it was the Seattle area.
Yeah,
and then they separated and were getting divorced. And she wanted to move back and he didn't want her to move back because he didn't want to just see his children, you know, summers and, you know, school vacations. But she felt like she was completely held hostage by him. She had no connections here. She didn't like it here. All her family and friends were on the West Coast. And then she ended up getting involved with an old, like a high school boyfriend. And she got pregnant. And so she was pregnant and he lived out there. So there was this incredible immediacy to her, like wanting to move, because if she wasn't able to, I mean, she could move. Let me be clear about this. The courts can't keep adults from moving wherever they want to move. That would violate the Constitution. But the court can say you can't take your children with you. Mm-hmm. So that's the issue. She wanted to take the children with her as a – and she was the primary custodial parent. But the father did see them frequently, and they lived close to each other in Philadelphia. So it was going to be a huge change for him. And anyway, the stakes were so high for her because she wanted to marry this guy, and they were having a baby, you know, and you can't stop that happening. And so it was very, very an emotional case. And I definitely felt badly for the father. I you know, represented my client zealously. And she, you know what? She felt badly for him, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no good solution to that.
Yes.
Those situations where someone wants to relocate with kids and they have a really compelling reason to do it, those are, I think, the toughest custody cases because it's just, you know, somebody really wins and somebody really loses in that case. And it's a hard – boy, I would not want to be a judge making those decisions.
Yeah, you point
it's
that
easier
out
to be an advocate.
You point that out in the book, too. I mean, does that ever affect the way you approach reaching an agreement when you have feelings for the opposing client?
Well, I think I always try to make sure that my client understands the perspective of the other side, both from a, you know, for human reasons and also because it's important for my client to understand how the other, you know, parent or opposing party, depending on the kind of case, how they're going to present their position to a court. Because a lot of times people going through these situations, I think they have sort of tunnel vision. They're not thinking about the big picture. And I want to make sure they understand, look, if we go into court, this is what he's going to say. And you know what? That's going to be very persuasive. So maybe we don't want to go to court. Maybe we want to try to settle this in some way that's less than what you want instead of going for broke because he's got some really good arguments and think about it from his perspective or her perspective. And I think that's a really important role for a lawyer in any kind of a case is to counsel a client about their, you know, realistic expectations for outcome and not just be a cheerleader and say, oh, yeah, sure, I can get you this. And that's not my job. And I do think that making sure that whoever I represent understands it from the other person's side is it only does them good in every way. You know, if they're co-parenting, they need to be able to think about the other person's perspective.
We're talking about family law. That means adoption, reproductive technology, domestic violence, marriage equality, custody, and, of course, divorce cases. Author Margaret Claw is our guest. Our number, 816-235-2888. Let's go to some phone calls here, and Jeff from Lawrence. Jeff, good morning.
Yeah, I was wondering if a postnuptial agreement can be an effective sort of tool in a separation that may or may not lead to a divorce.
Margaret, what is a postnuptial agreement?
Well, postnuptial agreement is just any agreement reached between people who are already married about various aspects of their marriage, as opposed to a prenuptial agreement, which is something people sign before they get married.
Sure.
Yeah. And yes, I mean, postnuptial agreement, we do them all the time. And in fact, all of our divorce settlement agreements, we call them postnuptial agreements, and they say in them, if the parties never get divorced, this is going to stay in effect forever. And if they do get divorced, this becomes the terms of their divorce decree.
Wow.
So it's really one and the same thing. Although sometimes sometimes people enter into sort of an interim agreement, which would be a form of a postnuptial agreement. You know, they're separating. They're not sure if they want to get divorced. They just need to figure out how they're going to pay certain bills maybe while they're living in two households. And they want to work stuff out about their kids or whatever. And we, you know, that's a form of a very useful form of postnuptial agreement. So it's a term that some divorce lawyers don't use. I'm not sure why. I mean, that's to me, there are only two kinds of agreements. There's prenups and postnups, and that's it. I mean, that's you can make a contract with your spouse or your fiance, just the way you can make a contract with your friend or neighbor or, you know, business partner. And these are contracts that we write up to set out what people are going to do.
It seems like a strange concept to me that you'd have a postnuptial agreement. You're already married and you're thinking about maybe you won't be married at some point.
Well, you know, people don't usually do them that aren't already separating. They're usually
I see.
They're and some or I would say this, though. Some people want to do a prenuptial agreement and they don't get around to signing it before they get married. And then afterwards, they do want to finalize it. And then it becomes a postnuptial agreement.
Yeah.
But most of the ones that I'm thinking of are people that are in the process of separating, but they're not ready. They're not sure they're getting divorced. So they just want to make sure they're taking care of things for this period of separation.
You know, handling so many divorce cases as you have, does it make you like never, ever want to get a divorce, having watched so many couples deal with it?
Pretty much.
Yeah. It's ugly, right? I mean, it's what we're talking
well,
about here.
Well, yes and no. I mean, yes, it certainly makes me not want to get divorced. And I've been married a very long time. And I think that I'm probably a better spouse because of my profession, because I realize how difficult it can be. And I don't sweat the small stuff with my husband. But I also see how transformative divorce can be for people who are in a really bad marriage, because I keep in touch with a lot of my clients. And also, I have a lot of cases that involve issues that go, you know, I may represent someone in a divorce, but down the road, there's future issues with that involve their children. So there's child support changes and custody changes. So I'm seeing people often years after they got divorced. And I mean, I have so many clients who tell me they are so happy they did it. It just may change their life for the better. And that's, you know, those are people who were in really bad marriages and were really unhappy. Maybe they were physically abused. Maybe they were just, maybe there just was no love there anymore. And they just were like, you know, miserable, quietly miserable for a long time. And so I do see how the benefits of divorce for people. But I think if you're not at that state, you should do everything you can to try to prevent it, because, right, it's a really horrendous process. Even if you go through it in the most amicable, civil way, it's world shattering for you.
If any of our listeners have been through a divorce and want to share their own experiences in dealing with lawyers and the law, 816-235-2888 is our phone number, our email address, UpToDate at KCUR.org, or tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. Margaret, in writing about the process of ending a marriage, you say this, that divorce is at its essence an economic transaction that needs to be negotiated like any other deal. It's that simple.
Yeah. Well, it's simple. The economics of it can be simple, but I think it is never simple, because it's more than money that the people who are getting divorced are dealing with, because the money, the house, the pension, they all are wrapped up with this emotional process that they're going through. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to it can be very hard to tease that out. But I do try to make sure I explain to clients and I repeat to them during this process that this is getting divorced, there's custody issues, and those are about your children, and those aren't related to whether you're married or divorced, because that's going to be the same if you never got married. And, you know, those are super important issues. How are you going to parent these children when you don't live together anymore?
Mm-hmm.
But the divorce part of it is extricating yourself from a financial partnership, basically. It's like the breakup of a business. I mean, that's the way modern divorce laws look at marriage. It's an economic partnership, and you have to sever it. And then the question is, how do you do that in the most equitable way?
Yeah.
I mean, it depends on the law of your state, but and that's what we're talking about. We're talking about dividing up assets and dividing up debts, and not who did what to whom, for the most part. I mean, divorce everywhere at this point is no fault, although there are, you know, there are states that have fault grounds for divorce available, but that is not, you know, the trend is really away from that. Like in my state, there's still some on the books, like you could file for divorce on the basis of adultery, for instance, but our divorce code doesn't include marital misconduct as a factor in how property gets distributed. So there would be no reason to do that. So everybody just files based on no fault, you know, because they want to get divorced or because they've been separated a certain period of time. And that's not something the court is, it's not even permissible for them to consider that. It's not, you don't get more of the 401k because the other person was a jerk. I mean, and that's in my state, and that, you know, that varies somewhat, but the trend is really clear. Like, there's no fault divorces the way that divorce laws have changed. And that's really stripping it down to its pure sort of economic elements.
So you don't get any more of the 401k if you're not the offending spouse. So do you just divide things right down the middle? Is that how what you're talking about?
No, well, not in states like mine, and I'm pretty sure yours, and the majority of states in the country. Divorce laws are based on a theory called equitable distribution, which doesn't mean equal. It means distribution based on a certain list of factors about what's fair under the circumstances. And those factors are usually things like, you know, the people's ages, their health, the length of the marriage, what each person contributed to the marriage, maybe what, you know, if somebody provided support for the other person to get an education. You know, they vary by state, but the idea is to take those factors into consideration and decide. Oh, and the incomes of the parties is huge, like earning capacity. So, mm-hmm. if one person earns, at least in my state, and this would be standard, you know, you have a sort of a breadwinner and a dependent spouse that doesn't work at all or has, you know, minimum earning capacity. Usually, that person's going to get more of the assets than 50% because the idea. Is to try to put people on as much equal footing as possible going out of the marriage as they were at the time the marriage was, you know, is ending.
So if one spouse makes $100,000 a year and one spouse makes $25,000 a year, and the better earning spouse has got $500,000 in a 401k, and the lesser spouse has $50,000 in a 401k, I mean, what happens there?
Well, the 401ks are going to be all put into the same pot and divided up. So that those are – but the income – and then – and so, again, I'm talking about my state, and this the laws really are different in every state.
Sure.
But alimony is another tool for trying to achieve that economic parity to some degree. So in a case like that, you might say – I mean, in my state, maybe – the wife in that scenario gets, you know, 60% of the value of the assets. And then maybe she gets alimony for a period of time, which is in addition to if she's getting child support, mm-hmm. Making an assumption. Maybe she's not. But alimony for a period of time to help her get back on her feet. Maybe she needs to go back to school. Maybe she needs to just get back into the job market if she's been out of it. Or in some, you know, very long-term marriages, we have in my state the possibility of indefinite alimony if you have someone that really is never going to be able to earn or someone that's disabled or something like that. So those are the tools.
So that means the alimony could go on for years then, you're saying, 10, 15, 20 years?
Again, in the state I practice in, if you have like a – you know, you have, let's say you have a 35-year marriage and you have a woman who, a wife who never worked and she's in her 60s, you're probably going to see alimony that's going to be it forever, but it would be modifiable. So when the husband retires, you know, it's going to go down.
Or if the woman remarries, then there would be an adjustment there, I assume.
If I don't know of any alimony laws that in any state that don't provide for termination of alimony when the person mm-hmm. getting it remarries.
All right.
And actually, in our state, cohabitation too. So if you're living with someone but not married to them, that would also terminate alimony.
Okay. Well, let's take a break here with Margaret Claw. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation about family law and her book, Keeping It Civil, The Case of the Prenup and the Porsche and Other True Accounts from the Files of a Family Lawyer. That book now out. It's a fun read, not a heavy read, a really interesting read. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here and our email address. UpToDate@kcur.org. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's discussions about the government shutdown with Congressman Cleaver and our conversation about President Obama and race, you can find that and all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the show, we'll look at the history of the Sunflower Ammunition Plant and get some personal stories from former workers, plus the latest editions of A Fan's Notes and 90 Mile View. This hour, we're talking about family law with author Margaret Claw. Our number again, 816-235-2888. Let's go to some phone calls now. And John from Kansas City, Missouri. John, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, John.
Hello. How are you this morning?
Well, thanks, John. Go ahead.
Good. I just want to address the financial aspects of divorce. I've been through it twice, unfortunately, but in the end, it turned out for the best. But in both cases, the financial aspects are huge. People go through a divorce, and they get a divorce decree, and they walk out of that court, and, you know, everything's been split 50-50 in most cases, and everybody feels halfway decent about it when they leave. But what people don't understand is that divorce decree absolutely means nothing to a creditor. In both cases, my divorces, I had to take bankruptcy. And fortunately or unfortunately enough, it was within the 7-year period where I could take bankruptcy between the divorces. But I went out of there thinking everything was split 50-50, but in the end, the creditors came after me because my ex took absolutely no responsibility for her debts, and she paid absolutely nothing. And I found out the hard way that the divorce decree means nothing to the creditors.
Margaret, why would creditors just go after, in this case, John, the male, instead of the woman who was involved in the case?
Well, it's really hard for me to comment on that specific case, but I would say this, that in a divorce, debts as well as assets can be divided. So you could have credit card debt, let's say, and you could let's say there's, you know, $10,000 of credit card debt, and you agree that that's going to be split and each party is going to pay half of it. But maybe all of those cards were actually in the name of the husband. So the divorce decree is enforceable in the sense that the court will say to wife, you need to make those payments. We'll hold you in contempt if you don't, et cetera. But the creditor is not a party to that agreement.
Yeah,
so the
sure.
creditor is only going to come after husband, and his then what he can do is bring wife in. She's indemnifying him is what it is. It's an indemnity agreement. But your caller's correct in that there's no way to make a person who's, you know, an entity like a credit card company, they are going to look to the person whose name is on the debt, and then it's up to that person to bring the other person in to pay their share if they're not paying their share. So I don't know what happened in his particular situation, but that is a problem, and that's something that needs to really be thought about when you are dividing up debts. And that's why, for instance, everybody wants a person who's keeping a house to refinance it into a mortgage that's only in their name, because even if the divorce decree says, well, you, wife who's keeping the house, you have to make all the mortgage payments, but that mortgage is still in both parties' names. If she defaults, the mortgage holder is going to look to the husband, ex-husband, as well.
Mm-hmm.
So those things really need to be wrapped up as part of the divorce settlement.
Okay. John, thanks for the call. Dave from Kansas City, Missouri, you're on Up to Date with Margaret Claw. Good morning.
Yes, there was a landmark case here. 6 months or a year ago, I think it was New York State, but it might have been California, where the judge broke the prenuptial agreement, and it's the first time that it happened. You know anything about that and how that's going to affect other prenuptial agreements throughout the states?
Margaret?
I don't know. Prenuptial agreements are governed completely by state law. There's no federal contract law or there's no federal divorce law, so every state has different laws about prenuptial agreements. So a court that refused to enforce a prenuptial agreement on some basis in like New York or California, that's only going to be binding on New York or California. And I don't know the specific case that you refer to. But what's interesting about prenuptial agreements, and this is something that I write about in the book, is that they can be looked at just like any other commercial contract, just exactly the same as an arm's length transaction between, you know, two business owners. And that in my state, that is how they're looked at. So it doesn't matter that, you know, the person was presented with it on the eve of the wedding and that they didn't have counsel. If they can read, write and understand English and they signed it, they're stuck with it. You know, mm-hmm. There's a few provisions that have to be disclosure to it. But other states have a different law about prenuptial agreements, and they don't look at them as the same as commercial deals. And they actually impose sort of a fairness test. So they and it's different again in different states, but they look at the content of the agreement, and if it seems like it's just way too sort of unfair at the time a divorce is happening to one of the parties, they might refuse to enforce it, or they might modify it. So it really varies state to state.
All right. Dave, thank you for the call. Appreciate it. You know, how common is it, Margaret, for clients to mistake you for a therapist and, you know, call you to cry on your shoulder and get whatever emotion they're experiencing off their chest?
Well, I think it is common at first, but I try to make really clear right away to clients that that's not a good way to
use your time.
First place, it's not a good way to use my time. It's really expensive because I'm going to bill them for time. That's how, you know, we get paid, is billing for time. Mm-hmm. And I don't have the expertise. So it's not a it's not a good fit in any way. And I'm, you know, I've been doing this a long time, so I'm pretty good at sort of shutting people down. I mean, not in a mean way, but just, you know, this is something you really should talk to your therapist about or your friends about. I think when I was a newer lawyer, I was more hesitant to do that. And I kind of, it was harder for me to be really clear about mm-hmm. this is my role and it's not to do this other thing. But again, that's probably one of those things that I share with a lot of people who practice family law, you know, successfully, who like it and do it for a long time, is that we are able to make sure that our clients understand that distinction, because obviously we can't do that.
It is amazing to me how quickly you gain incredible insights, fantastic insights into the people you're working with. I mean, you learn in a matter of minutes all kinds of things about people that you normally would never know.
Well, right, Steve. That's the thing. That's why I like it so much.
Yeah, right.
Because, well, so there's this courthouse saying that I really like, which is that criminal lawyers see bad people at their best and family lawyers see good people at their worst, which is – it has some truth
line.
To it.
Yeah.
It is a great line. I mean, it's an adage that, you know, floats around in legal circles. But I'm not sure I see people at their worst, but I see them at their most, I would say, raw. Mm-hmm. I see them when they are really usually in a state of some kind of crisis or stress. And so – for that reason alone, I get to know them really fast and I get to see who they are, you know, what's their character like. And so you have these intense relationships with people, and that I find that very satisfying. It's not, you know, it's not small talk. Like, we're talking about big things. And and so that is one of those reasons why I find it compelling. But people are relieved to be able to go into see a lawyer and tell them all this stuff that they maybe haven't been able to talk to their friends about, and maybe and not their spouse about sometimes.
Yeah.
So they want, especially money matters. You know, people don't talk about money. I think they're more likely to talk about sex with their friends if they have a sexual problem in their marriage. They're way more likely to discuss that with their friends or family than they are if they're worried about, you know, their spouse's like got a gambling problem and money's disappearing and they don't know why. And the people are ashamed of that, I think. And so I think it can provide a tremendous relief to just sort of get it off your chest.
You know, I laughed out loud when I read your reaction to what you call the dreaded category of personal property. You write in Keeping It Civil, "I try to avoid these negotiations like the plague. I generally tell clients I don't do furniture." And you don't do furniture, why exactly?
Because when it gets down to dividing up people's stuff in their house, it really has nothing – there's no legal – metric for figuring out who should get what. Like, mm-hmm. used furniture just doesn't have a value. I mean, it's mm-hmm. one thing if we're talking about like a painting that has been appraised or jewelry, like those things. Okay, so that's maybe, you know, in the asset category, that like a what's in a bank account. But most of what's in, I mean, I don't know about your house, but you know, most of what's in our houses, it's used couches, TVs, things people collected over their lives together. You know, they don't have monetary value. Mm-hmm. What they have is emotional importance. And so I don't know how to negotiate for that. Like, it's really hard to call up the other lawyer and say, she really wants that alarm clock in the guest room, you know, because she got it in college and she really whatever. You know, it's very difficult. And I just hope, and I know I'm not alone in this, my other colleagues, you know, that, and the court for sure, that people are able to just work that out. And you know what? Usually people do. It's not a common thing that people get stuck over stuff, but it does happen sometimes. And that is, I was writing about that issue in the book, as an example, a particular case where the whole case was settled,
right,
except there was this one painting that they both wanted, and the entire settlement fell apart, and we had to come back to court, and eventually we did resolve it. But I think it's just personal possessions can be so imbued with meaning to people that they become symbolic of maybe the marriage ending or whatever.
Did you resolve that one? How? How do you deal with a painting like that that both spouses want?
Well, actually, in that case, the thing that was extraordinary is that the judge resolved it.
He said, I'll take it. I like it.
The judge said, I like it. I'll take it. Yeah, that would have been a novel solution.
Yes.
No, the judge did this amazing thing where she actually told the people. We had a conference with her, I guess, and we had said, this is the problem. This is why we're stuck. You know, we have a settlement all worked out except for this one painting. And she looked at the painting on a book, and then she talked to them about it, and she understood it was so meaningful to both of them. She really acted like a counselor, and they both got to tell her in court why they thought it was so important. And then she said, you know, I can't really make a decision about this. I hear you both, and you're good people, and you need to just work this out. And then that, I think, because the catharsis of saying it in court, you know, why they both cared about this painting, then they were able to resolve it some way that the lawyers, we had already suggested, you know, well, maybe one of you gets that and the other one gets all the other paintings. Or there was I don't even remember.
Yeah.
But something that had already been proposed, but it was the logjam was broken by an extraordinarily sensitive judge who could have just as easily said, get out of my courtroom. I don't want to hear about this. You know, don't be babies. Work this out yourself. I mean, that's what I was prepared for when I went into that hearing that day, and that's not what I got, and I was pleasantly surprised.
Margaret Clough is the author of Keeping It Civil, The Case of the Prenup and the Porsche and Other True Accounts from the Files of a Family Lawyer. Margaret, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking some time.
Thanks, Steve. I really enjoyed it.